I'm here today with the famous and fabulous Kevin Annett from kevinannett.com. He's a journalistic, authoring, documentary filmmaker guy who used to be a Protestant minister, and the websites as well for his documentaries and other organizations are hiddennolonger.com, that's hiddennolonger.com, and www.itccs.org, that's itccs.org. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, now let's get a little bit of a background on yourself as a former Protestant minister. What exactly, what area were you operating in?
Well, after I got ordained a couple of years after, I was married and I moved with my two young children and my wife to the west coast of Canada. And the community I settled in, Port Alberni, was traditionally one of the most heaviest areas for missionary activity. So, in fact, most of the area was a large part percentage of it was Aboriginal people still. But the first day I stood up in my pulpit, I noticed there was not a single Indian in the congregation. So it started getting me out to ask questions. And those eventually led me to learn about the whole history of this Indian boarding school genocide that, you know, killed actually over 50,000 children over a century in Canada.
50,000 children over a century.
Well, that's probably a conservative estimate. The government admitted a few years ago, after a lot of lobbying and work by me and other people, the government eventually acknowledged that the death rate was about 50% in these institutions over decades. So, I mean, you don't have that huge a death rate if it's just accidental or, you know, random abusers. It's obviously a whole system at work. And that's the kind of thing I began to discover when I began working among the Aboriginal people.
Okay. Well, why did you begin working with them?
It's partly because that's how I saw my purpose, to open the doors of the church to the community. I was hired by quite a dying congregation. There was only about 10 people in the pews, and they wanted me to bring new people into the church, so I did that. I opened the doors. I invited in the community. We had a food bank. I did a lot of social work in the community, and I began to meet, inevitably, a lot of Native people, and they began to tell me these stories. It was interesting because right at the same time, historically, when the natives were beginning to sue the churches and government for this long history, you know, of terrible, terrible abuse and murder that had gone on in these facilities.
Well, specifically, what were they doing and how were they getting away with it?
Well, there was a law that came in Canada, similar to Australia, New Zealand, America, other countries, laws that forced all the native people to put their children in these institutions where from the age 5 and up, they had, wasn't really schooling as we understand it. They had like an hour or two of instruction a day, and then they were used as cheap labor. There was every torture you can imaginable, you can imagine, widespread child trafficking. There was an attempt to really exterminate large areas of the country of natives under the guise of Indian education. So, for example, I found documents showing that there were sterilization laws allowing any native who wouldn't learn English to be sterilized so they couldn't have kids. I mean, it was out-and-out genocide and eugenics. But a lot of this history was buried until I began to, and other people began to uncover it. First through the stories people were telling me, the people I began to meet.
What were some of these first stories that you were being told?
Well, it was funny. The very first week I started at St. Andrew's United Church as a minister there, I got invited out to a local community, and they in my film Unrepentant, which is up at that website hiddennolonger.com, I described that. I got invited to come out and perform a wedding at the home of a man called Danny Gus. He was a native man, and when we were sitting there after the service, I asked him kind of curiously why there were no Indians in any of the white churches, and he looked at me very oddly as if I was stupid or something, and it took him a while to answer, but finally he said, "They killed my best friend in that Alberni school. And he's buried in the hills behind the school with a lot of other kids. All the white people know that, and they don't want us in their church." It was that simple. And I heard those kinds of stories literally in every native home I went into after that.
I received an email from a listener, I believe, asking me about something I'd said on one of my shows. And I talked about child trafficking. and how all the authority figures that are involved that you would go to for help are on the take, and that's how it keeps continuing. So your child gets taken away by, say, Child Protective Services, say, in the United States. And then you think to yourself, man, they've unlawfully taken my child. So you go to the Child Protective Services agency and you say, look, there's something wrong here. What you don't know is that the person who gets assigned to your case is on the take and taking a cut from trafficking your children. And so you think, man, these guys are acting criminally. I'm going to go to the police. And then the policeman that you get to, who's in charge of the investigation, is on the take. And then you think to yourself, okay, well, I guess a doctor could be able to help me. They'd be able to prove that I wasn't abusing my child or anything like that for them to take him away. You go to a doctor, and the doctor they wind up assigning to your case is on the take. And then you get a lawyer or a judge, and they also wind up being on the take. This whole thing is just totally locked up and stitched up. It's a perfect circle of scumbaggery, essentially. It's very hard to penetrate unless it's exposed broad brush. So what you're doing is so honourable and connotes such human decency that I feel proud to even be speaking to you right now, Kevin, you know, to tell you the truth.
Well, you know, I began to get into this because I thought that's what you do when you're a decent human being, you know. When there's been a history of this kind of stuff, you try to get to the bottom of it. I began to open my pulpit to the Native people. They began to tell these stories from the pulpit. That's what I thought a Christian minister should do, to help the oppressed, give them a voice. I was warned the very week I started doing that. I was warned by church officials that if I kept doing that, I'd lose my job. And the reason I kept my job for 2.5 years before they finally fired me was I was so successful in bringing people in. And they were frightened. It's kind of like why people say, over 20 years of doing this work, why haven't I ever been sued? It's because they don't want this stuff in court, because all the stuff you're describing would start coming out. So instead, they try to destroy the whistleblower. And, you know, after I did get fired, they went to my wife. They offered to pay for her divorce if she'd leave me, which she did. She got custody of my two daughters. I couldn't get work anywhere. They blackballed my name everywhere. So it's the same way they deal with anyone who gets close to this stuff. But if you persist long enough, you begin to learn all of these things. And it's very much like how you say the system is, that for every honest person in the, you know, among the police or the lawyers or the judges, there's two or three that are actively working, either taking money or looking the other way. And that's why we can't rely on these institutions at all. In fact, I'm working with groups in different countries that are trying to set up common law courts separate from the jurisdictions of the government to indict, you know, these criminals. We're actually working on that now. We have material up online at itccs.org showing these crimes. And we're hoping it'll have a ripple effect and more people will do that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Would you be able to elucidate? Is there a specific case study that you could point to that actually illustrates the points I was trying to make about the different levels and agents involved in the corruption or the cover-up?
Oh, very much. I mean, for me, one example I can give you is in 1999, UNESCO named three cities in the world where child trafficking was unofficially sanctioned by police and courts and protected. The three cities they named were Bangkok, of course, everyone knows about Thailand, Rotterdam, and Vancouver, Canada. And, you know, that shocked a lot of Canadians when they saw that. But I know, having worked, you see, for many years, I was a street minister in Vancouver. That's how I got to know a lot of the low-income and Native people I still work with. The first thing you heard all the time, including from cops I got to know, was they mentioned this place, the Vancouver Club, which is the elite center. You know, it's kind of the members-only club for the elite in Vancouver. Well, there was a whole investigation of the Vancouver Club. It was proven that children were being brought in there every Friday night to be trafficked, to be used. See, these children, especially if they were Native, would never be seen again. They simply disappeared. And the police tried to investigate. The investigating officers were fired. In one case, he was found dead of a, quote, suicide. The newspaper reporters the were silenced. The judges involved in this child trafficking ring threatened to sue the newspaper, so they shut that down. And there was even a case, a very famous case in Canada, where in a place called Cornwall, Ontario, the child trafficking was so extensive that it involved the local Catholic bishop, the local member of parliament, And the papal nuncio for Canada, in other words, the Pope's ambassador to Canada, was directly involved in silencing the victims to keep the case out of court. The one honest cop named Perry Dunlop who tried to investigate it got fired from the force and actually thrown in prison for 6 months when he wouldn't cooperate in the cover-up. So those are the examples of how it operates right in the very system of you know, that people consider a democracy. But the reality is very different when you pull back the mask.
Well, the response that I gave to my listener who asked me this question is, I don't know who's on the take or what specific examples to cite. I simply talk to the activists and the people who are doing all this research and uncovering all of this stuff, and they just continually cite example after example of the same sort of symptomology. And I guess what I'm really doing is just taking a very broad brush stroke, and this is the way things work in reality. You know, I may not know the specific people or the specific names or the specific evidence, but I know the general rule of thumb, and I'm normally always correct.
Well, that's right. You know, you're very right when you say that it's important to look at the system causing it, because we can get caught up in the details and not realize that it's a whole system at work, and it's very old.
It's called a systemic problem.
Yeah.
You know, so
yeah, sure.
and it's global too. This is not just happening in Canada. It's also happening in New Zealand. I mean, I've got a friend named Dan Ryder, who has tapes of child workers admitting that the majority of their workers are pedophiles, and offering an opportunity to buy his child back for 40 grand. If you give me 40 grand, I'll give you your kid back. You know, on tape.
Wow. And the amazing thing is when those cases come out, nothing's ever done about it. The media will mention it for 5 seconds, maybe.
If they mention it at all, which they most probably don't.
Yeah.
Because they're afraid of getting fired.
Yeah.
It's a cold one. And what I've found is you can't rely on people doing their jobs. Kind of like when you're driving your car, you can't rely that everybody else will drive incredibly safely. You just have to assume that everybody's an idiot.
True.
And this is even more poignant when you're looking at any kind of government department, you want to get anything done. I mean, who do you report police brutality to? You report it to the police. So obviously they're going to unbiasedly investigate their own gang boys in uniform, you know, kind of thing. It's like if you've got a complaint with the Bloods or the Crips, do you go and complain to the Bloods or the Crips and just go, hey, man, you guys ripped me off some cocaine, yo. I need some compensation, yo. I want justice. Here's the justice we'll give you. Bang.
Well, it's true. And, you know, any self-governing body like that, judges, the military, the churches, they're all like that. And that's why, you know, when I was thrown out of the United Church, it's the same. And I meet a lot of ex-clergy. They face the same thing. You're soon to be guilty. And you have to go along and kiss butt and admit you're wrong. Because like they said back in the Middle Ages, the heretic is always wrong. The church is never wrong, right? So that's still the prevailing mentality. That's why the Pope can sign letters ordering the cover-up of child abuse, and he never goes to jail or faces trial.
Whoa. Well, I wonder, is the reason why all these organizations are self-governing is so that they can work with each other, yet at the same time work independently from each other, and if they can't cover up a scandal internally, they can go to these other organizations to cover it up for them?
Yeah, I see that in practice all the time. The you know, the classic case was when I was having a protest soon after I was fired. Two members of the local church officialdom came out and actually stole documents out of my briefcase. We had that on film. I went to the Crown Council and asked him to press charges. He took 5 months, and then he said no, he wasn't. Even though it was clearly a theft by these church officers, he wasn't going to press charges because it would be against the public interest to do so. And I said, what do you mean the public interest? He said, well, we can't prosecute the churches. And I said, oh, really? They're above the law? And apparently they are, you know.
Okay. great. Whoa. Have you ever noticed that the satanic principle is to, like, say one thing and do the direct opposite? You know, to deny with your mouth what you're doing with your hands? Is that what these church organizations are really all about? Indoctrinating people into some kind of Luciferian cult?
Well, I think definitely that's the spirit behind it. I, having been an insider, you know, you go into these things with complete naivety, and having been brainwashed and conditioned from a young age to think certain things, it takes a while to break out of that conditioning, right? But these church corporate, they're corporations, first of all, you know, that's the thing to realize. And the people sitting in the pews and putting money in the plates, they have no idea what they're really part of. And when they do start discovering it, they close down so quickly. It's an amazing form of mind control. Every clergyman that I knew cut off ties with me the minute I got in trouble with the hierarchy. Even though they knew that what I was doing was right, they just dropped me universally. And that's the kind of fear. It's a fear-based religion. You know, the whole message is God killed his own son. We're born into the world cursed and damned. I mean, naturally, people are going to have a very twisted notion of their own self and people around them.
Have you noticed that most Christians haven't actually read the Bible cover to cover and certainly can't quote scripture?
No.
If they all could, I doubt any of this stuff would be going on.
You're right. I agree with you. Yep.
What is the problem here? How long did it take from the American Old West, where everybody read the Bible to their children in the evening, where they had very limited government and very little crime because everybody was armed? The only reason why Jesse James and other criminals rose to notoriety is because they pulled off more than one heist without getting shot first. You know, that was a justice mentality, a self-sufficient society, all born out of this very basic book of laws, right? How come people don't read that book of laws anymore? In fact, people don't read any laws anymore. They just get told by some guy in uniform or in some kind of a garb, a frock of some description. This is the law, as I'm telling you. Really, can you show me that law?
Well, you know, people have forgotten the natural law that we all carry inside ourselves, where we have an innate sense of what's right and wrong and how we're to treat one another. And that's what common law is based on. But this, very few cops are even trained in common law. They're trained in statute law, in what the corporation tells them to enforce, basically to gather money. And so, you know, I was funny the other day. I was in a support group for members of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. There's a lot of charges that Mounties are bringing against their own agency for sexual harassment and harassment on the job. These 20 Mounties sitting in the room, they all know the score. They told me about drug trafficking, gun running that goes on, child trafficking that goes on within the RCMP. They're spilling their guts to me, but they said, what can we do about it? It's a military organization. We're tried in secret police courts. If we open our mouth, no court in the country can touch them. What do you do? You know, it's kind of like when you're a dissident in the church.
Well, how do you expose a fascist? You get them to act like it.
True.
Antagonize them. What would really, really tick them off? Getting the truth out there to everybody. That would really mess with their heads. Let's do that. You know, sometimes the best defense is a good offense.
Well, exactly. And in fact, we've done that a lot. One of the things that's really bothered them is when we hold occupations right in the middle of church services. We often go in with Native people and others and peacefully occupy the church during a mass. And we'll hold up a banner saying all of the children need a proper burial. I've done that all over the world with that banner. A couple of weeks after doing that in Canada, the Prime Minister announced that he was going to apologize for the Indian boarding schools. I mean, you got to hit them where it hurts, and that's in the collection plate. And the, you know, the tax exemptions. I mean, all of the churches in the world, especially the Catholic and the main Protestant ones, like the Church of England, they're all supported through tax, not only tax-exempt status, but the Vatican Bank has an agreement with over 100 countries called a financial concordat, where tax, and there's one in New Zealand as well, I looked it up, your tax money is being funded right into the Vatican Bank without you knowing it. And that's one of the ways they make their billions of dollars every year. So, I mean, how did that happen? Just these behind-the-scene deals where they're soaking the public to support their crimes. You know, I mean, those kinds of things should be canceled. You should write, ask your MP, I don't know how it works in New Zealand, but just say, tell us something about the financial concordat you have with the Vatican.
Hey, well, that might be an interesting thing to ask the finance sinister next time I have a chance to talk with them. Or maybe the prime sinister would know something about that. He used to work for the Federal Reserve Bank on the in New York for 2 years as Merrill Lynch's representative. He was the head of the European bond and derivatives trade.
These guys, they're all in the same club.
And then he comes to New Zealand in 2008, representing the Blue Party, campaigns on a platform of change, and then wins. And then after he destroys the country and gets it into more debt than it's ever been in its history, and reaches a $50 billion debt ceiling, he then gets re-elected.
Gee, small world. It sounds like Canada.
It sounds like the United States, too.
Yep.
Sounds like Tony Blair's in the Labour Party in England. It sounds like it sounds like everybody.
There aren't any borders, you know that. It's a one corporatocracy, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, this is what David Rockefeller said in his own memoirs, or I think he might have said it at a Council on Foreign Relations meeting. I forget which, but something along the lines of the national autodetermination that we've previously experienced in centuries past will be given way because the supranational governance of elite bankers is far more preferable than the than the other chaos, i.e. anybody having freedom is a threat to the banking system.
Oh yeah, definitely. Well, you know, I think that since they've acknowledged the fact that they rule the world, I think we should say back to them, we the majority, our allegiance to any of that system is over. No more taxes, no more chop up your credit cards, no more voting, just withdraw, let it fall, you know? I mean, that's our weapon as the majority, I think.
Yeah, I say do whatever you can and fight with any weapons that are at your disposal. I mean... Oh. You're clearly a prime minister material. By that I mean a prime Protestant minister kind of thing, because you've actually got the strong political belief, spiritual belief, the nature of a Christian, which is to do the right thing, no matter what the consequences, and also get involved in the community, get to know them, get to love them, and basically just be really involved and have your fingers on the pulse, really. Does that about sum up your kind of a methodology as a minister?
I've always done that, and I did it for a while in the church. I realized that you couldn't really be a Christian in the church. Just like if Jesus ever showed up, he'd be the first one chucked out of the church. That's a funny story. Actually, I remember a guy came to me once and he said, you know, Rev, you never tell us what to believe. And I said, well, you know, and he said, I was kind of worried because I haven't been to church much. And I said, well, Jesus only went to church once, and that was to trash the place. Right. So, I mean, I figured that it was because of doing those things that it caused the church to come down on me, and they had to totally blacken my name so that what I was discovering wouldn't be accepted as legitimate. So they've been trying to do that a lot, but you know, money can achieve just so much, and it eventually backfires on them. And in fact, a lot of people know about the work I'm doing now because of the extent that they were trying to shut me down, you know. So I mean, you know, these things can be, if we hang in there long enough, they can actually be a weapon on our side.
Well, it's kind of like, let's say there's an enemy, and you're the enemy for them, okay? And let's say they've got snipers and they've got a Tomahawk cruise missile. So instead of using the sniper and taking you out so nobody can see you, they try and deploy the Tomahawk cruise missile, and then there's this big almighty bang, and everybody goes, "What the hell was that? Let's do some investigation."
Well, exactly. They spent $250,000 throwing me out of the church. So everybody was saying, why are they spending so much money getting rid of this one minister? There's got to be something more to it, right? Why didn't they just quietly, you know, do something on the side? But it was the first public and only public defrocking of a minister in the church's history. So all of that was like red flagging it for a lot of people, you know, and that's where I began to get a lot of interest from people coming around after that.
Yeah. Well, I think it's like people have a real hunger and thirst for the truth. And I think that they simply need to be enlightened as to what it is first. Kind of like truth is like a drug. The first hit is always the hardest, and changes everything. But you never get that that big hit back sort of thing. You have to have more and more truth in order to get that sort of development, that same feeling that you once had. And I've had this experience myself just in the process of hosting this radio show with all these different people like yourself that I've been listening to. I think the last three or four people that I've had on the show have been theologians, Christian ministers, Christian ancient researchers, and of course yourself. And they all say the exact same thing to me, that there are very few real Christians left. The whole mentality behind it, the entire apparatus that was set up to propagate Christianity, has actually been this thing to hold it back. That it's there's an old saying, the hand you hold is the hand that holds you down.
Yeah, well, you know, I remember when I got ordained, I felt, the day I got ordained, it felt very odd, because it felt like these people who were saying all the words of, you know, bringing me into the church ministry and everything, it felt dead. They were saying the words, but there was no spirit of life there. They weren't able to practice anything of what they were saying. And I found that by and large, those are the kinds of people who are coming to church. On the other hand, the people out in the community who I met, who were the real examples of people who cared for one another, who believed in justice, trying to make the world better, they weren't Christians. They weren't churchgoers. So, I mean, I realized that it really has nothing to do with the labels anymore. It has to do with all of us witnessing to what we know is right and standing by people when they're being destroyed. And that's the sign of whether you're, you know, I think, worthy in this time that we're facing, you know. And a lot of the institutions are falling. We got to pull out because they are coming down.
Okay. How can we hasten this? You know how everybody tries to find solutions and have some kind of conclusion, some sort of an end game. You know, I don't back that mentality. Like the whole, this is where we want things to go with the perfection, and I'm only going to start trying to do this as soon as I've got the perfect game plan. I just say, look, have a look at the situation. Do you like what's going on? No? Well, then do something to stop it. Anything! Do it now. By all means. You'll actually start accomplishing your perfect world, whether or not you like it, by simply opposing the things that are bad within it.
Well, exactly. And, you know, it's a matter of holding on to that little seed of conscience that we all have. Any institution asks people to give that up. It's almost like they put you through a test. Can you prostitute your own conscience and loyalties to the people and things you love the most? And if you can, you've got the right stuff and you can rise up through the institution. That's why the people at the top or who are a part of the institution can never be trusted, because they've given up their humanity. It's only the people on the margins who keep holding on to that. And I found that time and again, so that I don't worry about, you know, the Quakers have this slogan, speaking truth to power, as if, you know, you tell the people in authority what's wrong and they're going to go, oh, my God, we were wrong. I'm sorry. Now we'll do what's right. That's a big illusion. We got to take out the energy, and because we don't have a lot of time left. I mean, look at what's happening to the world. This is a matter of survival now for our children, for the planet, for all of us.
And it's one aspect of a much larger scheme, of course. And pedophilia and Satanism ties into the global control grid, the New World Order system ad infinitum. It's really one of the core issues, I think. And most notably, it's one of the least known and least talked about. I believe partially this is because the information about child trafficking and child genocide is so traumatic for people to know the truth that they switch off instantly.
Yeah, exactly. That's my experience too. Why, you know, so few people, even though we've documented all of these crimes, it's out there. So very few people respond to what we're doing on the stuff, because it does strike close to home, because all of us in some way were abused, traumatized as children, just even growing up in this culture. It doesn't have to be physical. But just the psychic and the spiritual and the mental assault on us where we're told at a young age that what we're feeling and what we're thinking is wrong, we've got to conform to something else. All of that is a wound on us, and we don't like looking at that or dealing with it. But that unfortunately gives this dark energy and these dark people the power to operate openly and realize that people are going to be too afraid to take them on. When you look at the enormity of child trafficking, it's clear that it has the collusion of a hell of a lot of people who are pretending they don't know. But, you know, in your own neighborhood, it's going on. And the point is, people are not really willing to talk about it unless somebody forces the issue.
Well, we've got to force the issue then.
Yeah.
Have you noticed it's usually the people who've been really badly traumatized that you usually get involved? You're familiar with the concept of false flags, right? You know, imagine if people were staging false flags and kidnapping innocent people's children and, you know, masquerading as Christian ministers and police and things like that and freak them out to the point where they start attacking the system. I always thought about this, and I would never want this to be done. However, how effective would it be? Because I see that so many people that get involved in this line of research have either had it happen to them or had it to happen to people around them that gets them involved. Direct contact.
There's no more effective way of controlling a group of people than to threaten their children. And that's happened a lot in the Native people, a lot of the Native activists. You see, reservations in Canada are concentration camps. When you're on reservation, you're not a citizen, you're a ward of the state. It's like apartheid legislation. So they can come in and take the children, Aboriginal children, away whenever they like, and they don't have to be accountable for them. So a lot of the people who speak out have their children taken from them. It happened to me. They did it in a different way because I'm white, but they did it through the court system. My children were taken from me. That's the price you pay for speaking out. And instead of being traumatized by that, although I do carry the scars of that still, definitely, I said, well, to hell with them. I'm going to continue to expose this because they had no right to do that. So, you know, the reason we keep fighting back is because you reach a point and they can't hurt us anymore. They can't take anything else from us except our life, but that doesn't make any difference because the message carries on other people. And then they realize that, you know, it's the advantage of being a veteran in a war. The veterans have the best understanding of how to operate under fire. And that's why I think my job now is to link up with as many veterans as I can so we can pool our wisdom and our energy and our strength and become formidable, you know. You know, when Spartacus led the slave rebellion in Rome, the core of his army were not slaves, but trained gladiators, former Roman soldiers. They were the elite of that army, and they could provide leadership, and that's what we need more and more. Slaves don't rebel on their own. They've got to be led, unfortunately.
Yeah. I think it's similar to the sheep and the shepherd analogy. Yeah. One shepherd is leading people into a slaughterhouse, so you just replace them with another shepherd that leads them to greener pastures. Yeah, it's just that simple. Thing is, leaders have to be inspiring. Leaders have to be charismatic, and it's not very inspiring or charismatic telling them about their children being kidnapped and trafficked all over the world.
Well, the thing is that people can let loose of their chains. I don't think people have to remain slaves. They look for examples. And I remember the first time we occupied a church in Vancouver, I walked in there. There was 50 of us. Most of them were Native. And I walked in there with the local hereditary chief. We were standing at the front door. And I was initially afraid to walk in there. And then I realized, think of everyone depending on this. And I took the first step and then second step. And eventually we were in that Catholic cathedral and we filled up the place. And once somebody had broken the ice, it was easy for people to come in and then confront those priests. Their psychological armor that they had, like of being a priest, fell away. And they were just guys in robes and they were confronted for the crimes of the church. Somebody has to do that all the time, break the ice. And, you know, the other side knows that. That's why they take out people like me. That's why they try to delegitimate us and get people too afraid to talk to us. Because they know that what we're holding in our hands.
That's why they assassinate great leaders all the time.
In public. It's always public assassinations. Yeah. They made my defrocking public. They invited everyone to come in and watch as they, you know, destroyed my character publicly, and yet it backfired on them because media showed up and started asking questions. So it's a two-edged sword when they do that to somebody. They've got to make sure it's effective. And in my case, it didn't work.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was talking to Jeff Ordonez before our interview today, and I told him about this incident. It's interesting you mentioned being a veteran. Of faith in POW camps. I think it was a study done or whatever, but a number of US prisoners of war were in these camps, and the ones who were atheists or didn't believe in God or higher powers or whatever had a much higher death rate than those who had a strong spiritual faith. I believe it's because when you're alone in that room, no hope of rescue, and you got no faith, you're completely hopeless, and your body just refuses to go on living. If you, on the other hand, have faith, hope springs eternal, and it literally gives life where life couldn't even exist before.
Well, I think that profound kind of thing that you mentioned is recognizing that in life we're more than who we are. And when we plug into that higher self, if you like, that higher truth, it gives us that strength that's unbeatable. Some people call that God. Other people have their names for it. But I prefer to find that it's the common ground. And when you meet people in life, I remember when I was young, I met a guy who was almost 80. He used to hold one-man pickets of the local city hall. It was over issues of jobs and that, but every day he was out there with his picket sign. And I asked him once about why he kept doing it. He said, "I've been doing this over 60 years. I've been fighting for what's right in the world. It's what's kept me alive." And that's why I realized that we're not doing this out of charity work or because we're nicer people. It keeps us alive. It reminds us who we are. We're more than who we are. The earth belongs to everybody, not just a few wealthy men. And we're trying to reclaim the earth. We're trying to reclaim everything that's been taken from us. That's what gives us life. That's what gives me life and purpose.
In other words, we're trying to make those lies that we've been told and we once believed true again.
True.
Exactly. Right. Make them real.
Wouldn't that be cool if the government was looking out for people's best interest? Wouldn't it be cool if churches help people attain higher levels of spiritual growth and consciousness so that they didn't need the church anymore? Wouldn't it be cool if the medical industry saved more people than it killed? Wouldn't it be cool if the police were out to help and protect people from crime? You know, these simple basic concepts are just not real anymore.
And it's even subversive to suggest that. I know, it's crazy. Well, there's a really, you can find this on any Google search. There's a beautiful poem by Langston Hughes, a black writer in the 30s in America. He said, "Let America be America again." And it's an amazing poem. Of course, he's not just describing America. It could be anything, but it's basically this dream that we always, people say, is America. America has never been America to me, but one day it could be. Like everything you're talking about, one day could be. We could actually have all that if we create it. But all of that has to be created anew every day. It's not fixed in stone. You know the way we're taught that we're born into a democracy, things are given to us, it's guaranteed. That's how rulers keep us in line. It has to be created at every moment by us. There's no such thing as freedom in the abstract. It's got to be taken and practiced. Otherwise, it's not real. It's the same about your faith. It's the same about anything real. Love and justice, it's got to live in us first before it can breathe in the world. And so that's why it's all about personal examples, you know.
Well, that reminds me of a conversation I once had with a man my mother was seeing. I told him what I do, that I host a radio show and I give a voice to people who get ignored by the mainstream media, who get demonized, who have attempts on their lives, and people who are whistleblowers, environmental activists, and people from all different sides of the spectrum. And he says, Vinny, you're doing God's work. And I thought to myself, you know what? I don't classify myself as Christian. I'm not sure what I am. I just try to do the right thing. And the more people that I talk to about their different religious beliefs and what these big lies that have been told about the institutions and what they aim to achieve, I'm already achieving them. And I think it's because I've stayed away from all of those institutions.
You got it, man. Yeah. Good one.
That's funny, man. the world's a topsy-turvy place, isn't it? You gotta love it.
It is. It's crazy. Well, you know, you reach a point, and my wife Carol had an idea that I should go on the road with a comedy routine called Under the Robes, talking about what the church is really like under the robes. But work, you know, the thing, music and humor are the two things that free us from slavery, that free us from fear. And we got to use both all the time. And I forget that. And, you know, I'm so filled with experience and facts and evidence that it's easy to forget those basic things. So, you are doing the right work, man. Well, it's an honor to know you.
Well, if you like doing music and you like doing comedy, do you yourself sing or play an instrument? Or?
Although my children make fun of me when I do. But Carol, actually, if you look at our film Unrepentant, she used to go by the name Lori O'Rourke. She wrote a beautiful song in there at the end based on the Magnificat. Where this peasant girl Mary is told that she's going to bear the Son of God, right? And it's kind of like, wow, I mean, truth resides among the poor, among the ordinary people, kind of that whole message. And she's got a beautiful voice. She wrote that song, and I can't in any way match her talent and ability. But when we're together and we're singing, it brings out something in me that I don't have at other times, and It's something about singing, you know. Somebody once said that the human race sang before it spoke, and the speech center developed after singing. And I've seen that on wards where people have had, you know, when I used to do rounds in hospitals, people have had strokes. They're unable to speak, and yet at sing-along time, they're out there singing, you know, the old hymns they were taught as a kid. They can sing even though they can't speak. That's, you know, our mouths may be covered by our own fear, by intimidation, and yet that voice of song unites us and can bring out the truth when other things can't. So I really recommend it.
Well, yeah, I do too. I mean, me and my friend Mikhail, he's only kind of like woken up to the New World Order in the last couple of years, and I said, bro, it's because you're 50. You had to see about 30 to 40 years of the New World apparatus getting put in place in a totalitarian tiptoe fashion before you figure out what's going on, of course. And we get together and we have these jams, and when I sing, I do kind of freestyle, like songs come out, not rap songs generally, just all new songs. We just start playing, and after about 7 minutes or so, we've created a new song. And we're always talking about these things that are on our minds. I did a song about Disney. I did a song about Monsanto. I did a song about Raptor Jesus.
That's great. Well, you know, that's Carol's just a few feet from me plucking away on a guitar. She's planning some more songs. But
well, do you guys want to play something for us on the Skype here?
Do you want to play something right now, Carol? she actually wrote a great song about the residential schools, but I don't.
I don't want to do a whole song. I just want to do the one little thing I did for William. That's just a cappella.
Oh, okay. Do you mind?
Sure.
It's just a quick.
This is Carol.
Hey, Carol.
Hi.
Hey, Carol.
Hello. I can also stand, right? I can stand?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You want me to hold it?
Sure, thanks. Hi. Anyway, so I was just going to do a really short...
Good evening, New Zealand!
Evening, New Zealand. What's this? That's like devil stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is. That's because New Zealand's a satanic cult country.
I see.
And our prime minister is a Freemason.
Same as ours. Oh my God.
And his coalition partner. Same as yours.
I know. We have so much in common.
All right.
Okay, anyway. So I wrote this for William, and it
Well, say who William is.
Well.
Can I say?
Yeah.
William Coombs was a friend of ours. He was a native man who survived Indian boarding school. He died in the hospital under very questionable circumstances because he claimed to have seen Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip steal 10 native kids from a school back in the 60s, and he talked about it, and then he dies in hospital. So that was definitely foul play, I think. But anyway, this is about William, right?
This is like too much fuss because it's very, very short. Okay.
Live from Canada.
I wrote this actually years before he died. Anyway. Little man, precious son, who but you knows what was done? Flask of mouthwash, keep you numb, fucked for life by holy ones.
All right, beautiful.
She's got a lot more. You should have her on. Just to sing.
Yeah, well, you know what I was thinking about? I had a great idea the other day. It's called digital busking.
Yes.
So you go out to the street and you busk, but you film yourself while you're doing it, and then you upload the video of yourself busking and then have a link to your PayPal so that people can donate $1 or $2 or something like that?
Nice one. That's an idea.
Yeah. And the beauty of it is you'd have all these songs online, so people would be donating to different songs that you've performed at different times on a consistent basis, and this would allow artists who sing about good stuff to have a real connection with their audience and derive a real income from it. So they don't have to do a slave job and can focus on their music.
We're on it.
Good stuff.
Wow.
Okay. So we've kind of running towards the end of it. I was wondering if you'd like to close out with a prayer of some kind.
I think everything we've been doing is a prayer. I don't like, the traditional way of saying prayer is it acts as if one person is the link between the higher power and everybody else. And I always remember, and I've always felt that it's within all of us. You know, when Jesus said the kingdom of heaven is within us, you translate out those words in his language, Aramaic, and that it didn't mean kingdom of heaven. It meant the realm of eternity. So it's kind of like he's saying eternity is within each one of us. You don't need priests. You don't need a church. You don't need a pope. It's all accessible. So when I pray, I speak from my own heart, and I'm speaking for myself, but I hope that in that doing that, it touches something we all share. And I, at this moment, I'm very aware of all of the children who have passed on, who are looking to us to bring them home, to name what happened to them, to bring those responsible into some kind of justice where they can be held responsible. For the children tomorrow who might die because we don't do anything, you know, for the planet tomorrow whose health depends on what we do at this moment, I offer this call for a new beginning for all of us so that we can reclaim that for the future, for our children who are yet to be born. And I just want to also close, Vinny, by saying it's really good to know you. I feel really good. I hope we can do this again. I want to urge people to look at our sites, hiddennolonger.com, itccs.org. There's a lot we haven't said, but maybe next time we can go into more detail about kind of the work we're doing. We're working with people in Australia, survivors of Catholic schools there, and we're hoping to come down to Australia in your way sometime in 2013. So maybe we can actually meet up sometime.
We're organizing a number, or trying to at least organize a visit of a number of different people coming to New Zealand from the conspiracy research movement, because I think, well, New Zealand's a very international country by its very nature, because we're such a small country, but we're interconnected with all the other English-speaking nations just simply by the language. About a fifth of our population doesn't live in New Zealand. They live in other countries. You know, we're all over the place. And we kind of have this innate geographical knowledge of the world, far more worldly than a lot of cultures. And I think that it's important for people to now have an international presence. And one of the places, you know, where I feel that I can provide that is at least here in New Zealand, because we've got so many cool people here, man. I've been supported hugely by the conspiracy and otherwise known as the truth community here at, in this country, and I think it just needs to grow and expand and give more people more access to more people. You know, it's pretty straightforward. The more people you have involved, the better it becomes.
Yep, yep. Good. Well, we'll do it.
Thank you.
So, lastly, just to recap, Kevin Annett, journalist, author, documentary filmmaker, HiddenNoLonger.com, KevinAnnett.com, and ITCCS.org. Thank you very much for your time, mate.
Thank you, brother. We'll talk again.